From Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Newsmakers. I'm Ezra Wall in our studios on the campus of UW-La Crosse. And we have an interesting show today centered around a book that is being issued in a new edition. It's called Squirrel is Alive. And it is a book about the life and particularly the activities in the World War II era of Mary Rosted, who lived in the area. And we'll find more about Mary as our conversation goes on. Joining me for today's conversation is someone who is a Holocaust educator, but also was a close friend of Mary's. Daryl Klott joins me now. Daryl, welcome to Newsmakers.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Well, it's always fun when we get to when our lives intersect with our work, and I imagine that's the case getting to talk about your late friend Mary.
Yes.
Because you've been such a passionate Holocaust educator, and your friend Mary has such a unique story that we're going to hear about. The book is called Squirrel is Alive. Mm-hmm. So tell us who is Squirrel?
Who is Squirrel? That's a good question. Squirrel was Mary's nickname in Girl Scouts in Brussels, Belgium, where she lived. And she, when she started working in the resistance, and I'll tell about this later, when she left home, her parents had no idea where she was. She left because she thought that she was endangering their lives. And so she could drop a line every now and then saying Squirrel is Alive, and then they would know that she was okay.
Because that had been her childhood nickname.
Yeah, in Girl Scouts, yes.
It was an easy connection for them to make.
Yes.
Okay. Wow, that's really interesting. So the book is called Squirrel is Alive, and it's about her activities as part of the resistance in Belgium, and so talk about not only that, we're going to hear about that in a little bit, but prior to the war, like what was life like for her and her family?
Mary lived in a large Catholic family in Brussels and had a wonderful childhood. The beginning of the book talks, she goes into great detail about her childhood and her parents, and she was a typical teenager until the Germans invaded her country, Belgium, and came into her city of Brussels, and that's when she started doing her very important work in the resistance.
So she didn't just run off right away and join the army or something like that. She was a young teenager at the time, but still engaging in all kinds of little subversive.
Yes.
But when I read the book, I thought, well, that's a very teenagery way to approach resistance.
Absolutely. And she admitted many times she would kill her children if they ever did anything like that. You know, Mary was 16 years old when Belgium was invaded by the Germans, and she and her girlfriends started doing small things just to irk the German soldiers. Things like stealing their mother's sugar ration and putting it in the German gas tanks so that they wouldn't run, turning street signs around so they'd get lost. You know, simple little easy things, which became more dangerous.
Yeah.
To me, one of the most dangerous things that they did was that they would go on streetcars and they would, Mary described that all of the German officers had little, she described it as they were like little metal acorns that were sewed onto their uniforms, denoting their rank. Like the high officers had gold ones, and then down to the silver and then the bronze. And they would rub up against these soldiers, and they would they had a razor blade, and they would slice off these acorns.
Cut them right off
their
uniforms.
Cut them off, and they would get together at night and decide. It was like a contest. Who had the most gold ones, most bronze, most silver, bronze. Now, to me, that seems really dangerous. And other thing they did on the streetcars where they would put underground newspapers inside their jackets. I mean, this is dangerous. And the other thing, all of these people were conscripted. They had to work in factories to produce goods for the German war effort. And Mary and her girlfriends worked in a flashlight factory, and they figured out how to file something down so that the flashlight would pass inspection and then never work again.
Yeah, in the book it talks about how careful they had to be to file just enough.
Yes.
So that the switch would work briefly.
Briefly, exactly.
But as soon as the soldier or officer or whoever it was would be out and actually need the thing to work,
it wouldn't
fall to pieces.
Exactly. Very smart. So after a year of doing these activities, she was really worried that she was endangering her family. And so on a spring day, she was 17 years old, she left home. They thought she was going to work. She had a little spring dress and coat on, and she became a courier for the Allies, and she worked in the resistance. And she delivered messages from town to town, sometimes delivered ammunition. She would report on German troop movement, and she did this. She walked 1,000 miles in all over a one-year period when she was 17. And she was scared to death of mice, and many nights she had to sleep in haymows, and she had no money and no food. She would steal vegetables out of farmers' gardens. Once in a while, she would be lucky enough to sleep in a convent and actually get a meal. And at the end of, and she had many dangerous situations. She looked very young. She had pigtails, and she got away with things that she probably shouldn't have. But at the end of the war, she had been attached to the American Army, and she ended up in Frankfurt in Eisenhower's headquarters. And she fell in love with an American soldier, Alan Rosted. And I'm a hopeless romantic, so I love this part of Mary's story. She had many experiences with his friends, the American soldiers, and they ended up getting married in Mary's home with her family there. And then he had to go back to his unit, and then she came over on a war bride's ship, and she told about these many, I think there were 50 of the war brides were Holocaust survivors that had married American soldiers. And she said they were just skin and bones, and many had the number, you know, tattooed on their arms. And then she tells about what it was like to arrive in Houston, Minnesota. Houston, Minnesota right now has, I think it's 975 people.
Yeah.
And I don't know how many there were when she arrived in 46, but it couldn't have been too many. And she tells about it was very difficult for her. She was not accepted. She was looked at as the other. She had a very heavy French accent.
Okay.
I've heard this from Holocaust survivors that came to America.
Mm-hmm.
They were the other. But of course, it didn't take long, and Mary became beloved and in that city. And she had a wonderful life with Alan, and they were married for 61 years.
That's amazing.
Yes, he passed away. He was 84 years old. He passed away in 2007. But Mary had a wonderful life in Houston. She was the ear-piercing queen of Houston County. I think she pierced every young girl's ears in Houston County. She was a nurse. She worked at Gunderson Clinic. And, the book has many, many wonderful stories about Mary.
Yeah.
She was known for her salads. She worked the night shift, and she would bring in her salads. Sometimes they were so big that she'd have to put one on a wheelchair because the bowl would be so big. And if any time that people heard that Mary brought a salad, I guess the interns would show up from all over the place, and you know, the place would be full.
Yeah, in the book it said on those nights Mary brought a salad, everybody working in the building somehow had some reason to happen by her department.
Yes, yes. And she tells, I loved this woman so much. She became a mother figure to me when my own mother passed away. We became dear friends. They would somehow take down ceiling tiles and put extra things that they wanted and needed so that they wouldn't be taken away. And she said she wondered how many workmen actually found these things up there and wondered what the heck is going on here, you know.
so things like extra like linens or something.
Yes,
like that.
Yes.
She wasn't sure they'd be able to get after after that department left for the day.
And one of my favorite stories, it was New Year's Eve, and there was a young intern who came in and who was on duty, and Mary had made rum balls. And the young man didn't really understand, evidently, that how potent they were. And he ate several of the rum balls, and he fell asleep. he wasn't doing his job.
Oh. Let's hope he didn't try to do his job.
Right, let's hope he didn't. Yeah. No, there, the book is filled with delightful Mary stories besides the main one, which is her work in the resistance.
Yeah. A lot of people from that generation, both of my grandfathers served in World War II. I know nothing about it.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds like in her family that might have been the same thing. And in fact, she didn't talk about
that
for
Mary
years.
Didn't talk about it. Her kids didn't know about this until, well, actually it was a Lutheran pastor in her city of Houston who knew something about this and asked Mary if she would speak. And she did. And up until then, she had never mentioned a word to anyone about her work in the resistance. And I remember Kim and Denise, son and daughter, talking about how they were sitting and listening to her present, and they were looking at each other and saying, like, did you know that? I didn't know that. Did you? I mean, they had no idea that their mother was a hero.
Mm-hmm.
But thank goodness they did learn.
Yes.
And they're extremely proud of her.
Yes. So, in the book, she talks about, and you mentioned it earlier, she goes away, like, she leaves for whatever she normally would have left for that day.
Work.
Leaves for work and doesn't tell her parents, even though she knows, she doesn't tell her parents that she's leaving more permanently and doesn't tell anyone. She talks about even stopping to see her aunt on the way out of town.
Mm-hmm.
and how hard it was for her not to reveal
mm-hmm. right.
what she was about to embark
yes,
upon.
Yes, because she felt that if they knew, the authorities could come looking for her and that they could get in trouble. And it was better that they knew nothing.
Yeah.
One of the things that I think about a lot is she left home at age 17, and this was a whole year of her life. She was extremely lonely. You think about teenagers. I mean, she couldn't trust anyone. And so she spent that year by herself. And she talked about how really lonely that was.
Yeah.
That's just one of the many wonderful things that Mary did. But I really want to emphasize that it isn't always easy to stand up and do the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
But Mary did.
Yeah.
And this whole thing, the whole Holocaust, could not have happened without the bystanders. People who, when they saw injustice occur, they did nothing to stop it.
Mm-hmm.
What we need to do is we need to be upstanders. And we need to speak up when we see injustice occur.
Well, in the book, it talks about how much she related to Niemöller's commonly quoted thing that I'm going to mess up because I'm not reading it, but it's the thing about they came for the first group and nobody did anything, and they came for the second group and nobody did it, and on, and then they came for me and there was nobody left.
Exactly. That's how she ended every one of her presentations with Martin Niemöller's.
Oh, wow.
She loved that. Oh, I heard it recite so many times. I wish everybody could have known Mary. She was so dear. I was so lucky to be her friend.
Isn't it interesting how these people come in and out of our lives and we have no idea why, but they make such an impact.
Absolutely. And that's Mary.
She was gone from her family. This is back during the war. She leaves her family. She's part of this resistance. And she returns after an absence of 2 years, right?
Well, she was gone for a year.
Okay.
And then what happened was she ended up in Eisenhower's headquarters in Frankfurt, and that's where she met Alan, and they fell in love. And then they ended up getting married, and they came to the United States. She came to the United States in 1946.
Yes.
And I can't even imagine what it would be like to leave your home and go thousands of miles away. But she did it because she was in love with Alan.
Mm-hmm.
And she would tell, she was a Girl Scout leader in Houston, Minnesota. And she would tell about these, her little Girl Scouts. They thought this was the most romantic thing that they had ever heard, that Mary had left her home for love. And I just think it's beautiful.
Yeah. It's, I'm wondering though, when she did get to be in touch with her family again, after she left, did she talk about what their reaction was to, I mean, in the book it says they were very happy to see her
yes.
and everything like that, but was there any like admonishment about like, why did you do this? Or was there an understanding of okay, this hurt a lot, but you did really important work.
I believe that they were proud of her.
Okay.
Because what she did was very dangerous, and she did the right thing. She never talked to me about her family being mad at her or acting that way. I think they were so happy to see her again. But just think, she wasn't home very long, and she got married and left for the United States.
Yeah.
Mary did get back to Belgium several times to see her family. But I can't that had to be so difficult.
Yeah.
But she loved Alan.
Now you've mentioned her family a few times. How big a family was it? She had how many siblings?
I think there were five altogether.
Okay.
I believe there were five altogether.
Okay.
Most of what Mary didn't dwell on the past very much. And actually, what Mary and I talked about more was her work in the resistance.
Yeah.
Because that's what she would present on this for me on that topic. I don't know. Would you like to know how I ended up getting to know Mary?
I would. Let's step away just for a second. You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. If you'd like to get in touch with our program, you can contact us by sending an email. It's newsmakers@wpr.org. That's newsmakers@wpr.org. Our program continues in a moment here on Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. It's Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Ezra Wall in La Crosse. Thank you very much for listening. We're talking about the story of Mary Rosted today. My guest is Daryl Klott, who was a friend of Mary's and is an active Holocaust educator as well as that. And so it's a very interesting intersection and a perfect combination. And let me tell you about the book first, Squirrel is Alive, A Teenager in the Belgian Resistance and French Underground. It's newly re-edited and being released now and is available in La Crosse. You can pick it up at Pearl Street Books. If you're not in La Crosse or if you don't happen to be going downtown anytime soon, you can find it on the website of the publisher, which is Fulcrum Publishing, and perhaps other online retailers as well. And with that, Daryl, we were about to talk about how you got to know Mary. We've heard all of the harrowing details of her work in the resistance. When did you first meet her?
Well, I was teaching at La Crescent High School, and I was doing a 3-month unit with all of my English classes. And I heard that there was this woman living in Houston, Minnesota, who had worked in the resistance against the Germans.
The 3-month unit is specifically
Holocaust unit. Yes,
right?
A 3-month Holocaust unit with all my freshman English classes. And when I found out that there was a woman that worked in the resistance, I got very excited because I thought, boy, oh boy, I would love to have her come to my classes. So I called Mary, not knowing her from Adam, and I explained what I was doing, and I asked her if she would come to my classes, and she came. And I had 5 English classes, and for several years, Mary came and spoke 5 different times when she would come. I know. And finally, she said, Daryl, is there any way that we could maybe put some of your classes together, get them out of their other classes, and maybe I could just speak 2 times? And I mean, yeah, duh, yes. You know, she's getting up in years. And so then we would pull everybody together, and she would speak to 150 freshmen. And I got to tell you, she had them in the palm of her hand. These kids, you could have heard a pin drop. They loved her. Her story is, it's so beautiful. But that's how I got to know Mary. That's how it started. And then when I retired in 2004, after she'd been coming to my classes for several years, and I had been asked to teach History of the Holocaust at Viterbo. And so I continued to have Mary come and present. I had her present at Viterbo. When I taught a class at UWL, I had her present there. I run a Holocaust educator workshop at Viterbo, and I had her come to the workshop. I had formed a Holocaust education consortium of some very strong Holocaust educators from around the country, and they would come for a 3-day conference in the summer, and Mary would always come and speak there. And finally, I decided it was time that we have Mary's book written. And so I ask Rick Kai, Director of Ethics and Leadership, the man that I work with at Viterbo. Mm-hmm. And he, of course, thought it was a great idea. So we hired Susan Hessel, who was a local historian and journalist. Many people are familiar with her work. Unfortunately, she passed away from cancer. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I'm all excited. And I go to Mary and I say, Mary, we're going to have your book written. And she said, no.
Uh-oh.
I'm like, no, I think this is the greatest thing I've ever heard. And she and I go, Mary, why? And she said, because I'm having a lot of lower back pain. And Daryl, I cannot sit for hours on end for it to be interviewed. I said, OK, no problem. How about if I have Susan come every time I have you speak and she can tape record you and she can write the rough copy, and then we can finally get you two together for a face-to-face interview. And that's exactly what happened. Susan came every time I had Mary speak, and which was several times.
Okay.
And finally, it was time for, I got the rough copy that Susan had written, and I took it out to Mary so she could read it ahead of time and make notes. Mm-hmm. And finally, it was time for me to take Susan out to Mary's home. And by the way, I took many media people out to Mary's home in those years, TV, radio, newspaper, magazines. Mm-hmm. And they would always be quite surprised because they would be met by Mary. She would have her dining room table beautifully set with her best china, and she would have made all these Danish pastries, and we would sit and have coffee and
I read your description of that in the afterword of the book, and yes. I was immediately jealous because I've been in this business for over 25 years, and never have I ever showed up to a story and had that, you know, lavish treatment.
Yeah, they couldn't believe it. I mean, she was something else.
That sounds amazing.
Yeah, it was. So anyway, I took Susan out, and Mary had written a lot of comments, you know, on the manuscript. And Susan and Mary were able to speak together. I think we were there for a couple of hours that day, and they both learned some things that they needed to know. And then there was only one more meeting, face-to-face meeting between Mary and Susan, and that was when Mary was in the hospital shortly after we'd been together, and Mary passed away from pancreatic cancer. And so...
And what year was that?
At age 87, October 13th, 2011. And the book came out in 2012. So Mary never got to see the book. But her children certainly did, and it's beautiful.
Well, she got to see a glimpse of the book in that first draft.
Oh, yeah,
right?
She saw the first draft, and I think, well, I know she was very happy with it. She has three children. She has her son, Andre, who's living in La Crescent, and then she has Kim and Denise. And Kim and Denise are both retired now, Andre also. And Kim and Denise are very active in promoting the book. And we have an educator in Westby, Wisconsin. His name is Dave Nelson. And he's been teaching Mary's book since it came out in 2012. Kim and Denise gave him a classroom copy, a classroom set of books. And every year, his seniors read this book, and then Kim and Denise go to the classroom, and these students get to question them about what it was like living with Mary. And they bring in her little tiny, it must be about a size 1 or 0, little army jacket, and they bring in many photos. And I was really honored I got to go this year. We were here in February when they went out. And I'll tell you what, magic happened in that classroom because they got to, the kids of this hero. Mary was a hero.
Yeah.
And they can ask her all about what it was like growing up with Mary. And then the kids tell how the book affected them. And it very definitely affected them. You know, this is a book about a teenager and their teenagers. The major thing to me is that they realize they can do something to help. You know, when they see injustice occur, they can step in. If they see somebody bullied, they can step in. I think it's just a wonderful thing. And I'm hoping now that when we release this book again, the new one, that we can get more and more teachers involved.
Well, for people who might be interested in that, not just teachers, but book groups and anything else, mm-hmm. There's a discussion guide in the back that includes some really probing group discussion questions that could easily be scaled for, you know, to be either academic, like school appropriate,
oh, absolutely.
Or like private, you know, book club appropriate.
Absolutely. And not only that, Ezra, I am in the consortium that I founded in La Crosse many years ago, the Midwest Holocaust Education Consortium, we ran it for 7 years, and then we disbanded only because this was a group of movers and shakers, and they were all extremely busy, and we had a really hard time coming up with a date that worked for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
But a very good friend of mine, Dana Humphrey, is resurrecting our consortium.
Oh, wow.
In St. Louis, and we're going to meet this summer, July 10th through the 13th. And they, all of the consortium members, have received the copy of this book, and we are going to create a really great study guide to go with the book.
Oh, that'll be very interesting.
It'll be really helpful, yeah. I think. I think that's going to be really wonderful. I want to read something to you. Dana Humphrey, the one that I mentioned that is going to resurrect our consortium, she was she heard Mary speak various times because she was at the consortium that I founded, and also she spoke many times at our Holocaust Educator Workshop. And there's something called a found poem, F-O-U-N-D. And a found poem is something that you create when you hear someone speak or you read something and you just take words and phrases and you put it together in a poem.
Okay.
And this one, I love this. This is what Dana wrote. It's called Lessons from Night School, How to Be a Squirrel, in honor of Mary Rosted, by Dana Humphrey. Turn street signs around to confuse the Nazis. Take a gun butt in the head for refusing to get off the sidewalk. Steal your mother's sugar ration and put it in the Nazi gas tanks. Sneak underground newspapers in the pocket of guards. Trade silver and gold uniform buttons sliced off with razor blades. File down the switches of Nazi flashlights so they are useless. Sleep in church pews, barns, and empty rail cars. Fake a toothache with tears. Learn how to live alone without friends. Remain silent for 30 years. Receive the 1986 Ellis Island Medal of Honor. Share the story of resistance. Become a hero.
That's amazing.
Is that,
what, that and that's that poem is in this book.
Yes.
But everything that poem illustrates is
in
the book.
The book.
Is straight from the story.
Exactly.
That's amazing.
I just think it's beautiful. And I did the eulogy at Mary's funeral, and I used this.
Wow.
I closed with it. Pastor, the local rabbi who now lives in Minneapolis, Rabbi Simcha Prombaum, he had an award that was given every year, an educator's award that was given for people who were involved in Holocaust education, and Mary won the award 1 year. And he said to me, "What do you think of when you think of Mary?" And I said, "She was a hero. She was a hero." And that's what I think. That's the main thing I think of Mary.
Hmm.
But to me, she was so much more than that because she was my dear friend.
I wanted to, you're reading that poem reminded me. It talked about the Ellis Island Medal of Honor.
Yes.
She was this person who did all these amazing things. But by the time that award was handed out the first time in I believe, in the 80s.
1986.
She was, you know, a Gunderson Clinic nurse who lived in Houston, Minnesota. And that's how most everybody who knew her, that's all they would have known about her life. And here she is among the very first class of people to receive this Ellis Island Medal of Honor.
Right.
I mean, alongside Rosa Parks herself.
Absolutely.
It's amazing.
Yes, Muhammad Ali. I mean, many famous people. And it was it's still going on.
Yeah.
And she won it the very first year. And she tells how she was representing the grassroots. And, you know, she and Denise went shopping so she could get a new pretty dress for the occasion. And I tell you, okay, this is one of my favorite Ellis Island stories about Mary. The first time I went to Mary's house, I knew about the medal. And I asked if I could see her Ellis Island Medal of Honor. Now, this is a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
She couldn't find it. She was searching through drawers.
Wow.
going around her house. And in the end, I didn't get to see it then, but let me tell you, she found it later and she had it displayed so that when I came, which was pretty often, I would see the award.
Okay. Well, good. At least she was able to locate it.
She did locate it, right?
It's the frustrating thing about knowing people who are so great and yet they're so humble. Is that they, you know, when you ask for it to see the award or to see the document or to see whatever, I don't know what I did with it. I don't know what I did with that. But I'm glad you got to see it.
She was so humble. You mentioned it. Yes, she was, and she was so sweet. I have said it before. I wish everyone could have seen Mary and known her. And by the way, we did have her speak at Viterbo. We started bringing survivors to Viterbo in 2005 was our first one.
Okay.
I'm very proud that in the last 16 years, we've had 19 Holocaust survivors at Viterbo. But part of that series, we had Mary speak. And I will never forget, I had asked Rick Kite to have I wanted a nice, big, comfortable chair because Mary was having back issues. I knew that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she's speaking in front of 1,200 people, and I rely on Rick to get this chair. So he calls the theater department at Viterbo. We show up that night, and there is this big, ugly, brown plaid sofa sitting on stage. That's where Mary sat. Okay, anyway. So we introduced her, and she was sitting down in the front row, and her son, Kim, put his arm out, and she put her arm around his arm, and he helped her up the steps. She sits down on that sofa in her purple dress that she'd worn to her granddaughter's wedding that summer, and she crossed her legs and she looked at the audience and she spoke for 45 minutes straight.
Wow.
Without a note. And everyone in that audience was just taken.
Mm.
And then there was a Q&A and no one left. I mean, it was beautiful.
Yeah.
And she was so worried because she'd been... There were several Holocaust survivors that had been there before her and some pretty big names in Holocaust mm-hmm. education. Elie Wiesel was one of them. I mean, and she was so scared and she was so beautiful and she did a great job.
That's wonderful. We're talking today with Daryl Klot, who, as you can hear from the emotion in her voice, was a very dear friend of Mary Rosted, but also is a Holocaust educator and has been very active in this area, not only in her former work as a teacher at La Crescent High School, but also in various other capacities in the area of bringing this kind of education to our residents. We're going to continue our conversation in just a moment. If you'd like to find a previous episode of this show or catch part of this conversation that you have missed, you can find them on our website. It's wpr.org/newsmakers. That's wpr.org/newsmakers. We're continuing in just a moment here on Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. It's Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Ezra Wall, talking today with Daryl Klot, and we're talking about Squirrel is Alive, a teenager in the Belgian resistance and French underground. It's a new edition of that book has just been released from Fulcrum Publishing. It's the story of Mary Rosted, who a lot of people around here might have come in contact with as a nurse at what then would have been known as Gunderson Clinic. And as a resident of Houston, Minnesota, but who had this remarkable, remarkable story that was not known until, not widely shared anyway, until later in her life about her work in the Belgian resistance during World War II. I'm interested, Daryl, as I was reading that book, there are some unmistakable parallels to issues that come up even now, that the ideas of standing up when people are being oppressed, these ideas of all of these concentration camps in Europe, which have been preserved for the purpose of telling and retelling the stories, even the ones that, especially the ones that reflect badly on those countries in the hopes that those things never happen again. And I'm reminded of the unmistakable parallels in our own country, where so many people are fighting to make sure that American history is accurately represented in mm-hmm. our schools. As you're looking at the reissuing of this book and the new edition of this book, I'm wondering why you think a book like this is important to keep in the public mm-hmm. eye.
Because Mary did the right thing. Because Mary stood up when she saw injustice occur, and she was not a bystander. And I know the book is great for people of all ages. And by the way, she's not a Holocaust survivor. We don't go into the camps. It's a gentle book. Mm-hmm. Young people can read the book. We need to be vigilant, and we need to stand up when we see injustice occur. I keep harping on that, but that's so true. And Mary did that. And as I said, this is a book for people of all ages. But what I really think, teenagers can read this book. It's about somebody their own age, and they can. I think they can relate and say, "Wow, look at what she did. I can do something." I'm not saying you have to run off and, you know, go to some foreign country and do good work right where you are, right around you.
Yeah.
People often say to me, because I teach history of the Holocaust and did for so many years, and they say, "Well, Daryl, what can we do? What can we do?" And I say, look at your own world. Look at the people right around you. You know, if you see some injustice occur, even something like people making racial slurs, making racial jokes, you can say something to that person. You know, you don't have to do it right in front of them, but you can get a hold of them and later and say, you know, that's really not right. You shouldn't be doing that. You can write letters to the editor. I mean, there are many things that as citizens that we can do.
When you think back about Mary, Mary's been gone a little over 10 years now,
mm-hmm.
about 12 years.
2011, she passed away.
So what do you miss most about you've talked about she was a hero, but as a friend, like, there's more than hero there. What do you miss most about your friend, Mary?
My friend, Mary. I probably will be on the verge of tears. I mentioned that after my mom passed away, Mary really did become a mother figure to me. And I just loved her. I just loved spending time with her. I loved hugging her. I loved listening to her speak. I loved everything about her. I loved how she loved her family. I loved her. She was warm and cuddly and loving, and I miss her a great deal.
And she, you talked about how much she loved her family. The part of her story that really kind of hooks you is the love story angle of it, which is amazing. But she got to enjoy a good long life.
She did
with her husband,
61 years. And now you're bringing this up,
yeah?
Because I am a hopeless romantic. And I want to share.
A self-admitted one.
Yes, I don't care. I am. I want to read a love letter, and it's in the book. Do you remember this love letter?
I do, yeah.
Okay. When Denise had been, her daughter had been teaching in Whitewater, and I think it was Whitewater, and when she retired, she ended up moving into Mary's house in Houston. And she found a packet of letters tied with a ribbon, and they were love letters between Mary and Alan. While they were waiting to be reunited. And this, I have one, and it was written on October 25th, 1945 in Germany, and it's from Alan to Mary. "My Mary darling, I've written one letter tonight, but now as I was going to bed, I was seeing your most beautiful face again, and right now I'm hearing stardust from the next house. So you must know how I feel and what I'm thinking. Darling, what is it that makes me love you so? Tell me, dearest, what is it? You know, Mary, as I'm sitting here writing, I can see your face just like you are when you smile, and you seem so real, as if I could reach out and touch you. Please don't laugh at me for saying that, because it all seems so real, as if nobody but you are here with me. But that is the way it should be, is it not, darling? You're the only one that should be in my mind and in my heart. I was looking at your picture a little while ago, and please don't laugh at this, but I almost cried. It's just that without you, life doesn't mean a thing to me. That's true, darling. I don't care what happens. I'm coming back. It just can't be any other way for me. Darling, now I'm going to bed and dream about you. I'll meet you in a dream tonight. Good night, my darling little wife. This I say with all my heart. Here are a million kisses from your husband. Love you, darling.
And the reference to Stardust there at the beginning is because that song, Stardust, had been a song that they enjoyed together during the brief time that they were able to hang out before he was called away again.
Yes. He was madly in love with her. And I have to tell you something funny. Denise and Kim have told me that Alan was an old Norwegian, a very stoic, a wonderful human being, don't get me wrong. But he was not a romantic.
No, but like we live in this part of the world. We know the kind of people you're speaking of.
Yeah, yeah.
You're not talking about people that we don't know, Daryl.
Right.
You know, it's wonderful people, but like not terribly emotive.
Exactly. And that's why.
And yet this letter comes pouring out of him.
Yes. Yeah. I know. Which I just think is so great.
That's wonderful.
I love it. From your husband. Love you, darling. I mean, come on. It's beautiful. No wonder they had 61 years together. And no wonder the Girl Scouts were carried away with Mary, the romantic notion of Mary leaving her home and her family way over in Brussels, Belgium, to come to little dinky Houston. Oh, and in the book she tells about what it was like coming to Houston, riding on some rickety train once she...
Yeah, she talked about the train she was on initially stopping in La Crosse, and then she had to get on this sounded like a little cargo train that went from La Crosse over into Houston County, into Spring Grove, I think.
Yes, where he could pick her up.
Oh. And the engineer, in the book it said the engineer was so apologetic because he estimated that there hadn't been an actual passenger on the train for so many years that the actual compartment where the passengers were to go was all like dusty. And
yes, yes. And you think about Mary coming from cosmopolitan Brussels, Belgium.
Wow, yes.
To this little dinky town. Oh, my goodness.
We have a few more minutes left, and I don't want to go too far back in the story, but you talked about her leaving her family to become part of the resistance. You talked about her falling in love and getting married and moving to America to start her new family here. And then the book says that it was quite some time. It was in the 70s before she had an opportunity then to go back and visit her family. Is there any sense that she regretted that gap of time or anything like that?
Never. I never heard her speak of regret. She loved Alan, and she followed him to America, and I don't believe she had any regrets.
Do you know how many times she was able to visit Belgium again?
I know that she went over with her daughter Denise, and I'm going to say maybe around a total of 4 or 5 times.
Okay.
To me, it's utterly amazing that she did this for love. And you mentioned Mary Rosted's name over in Houston. Now she was beloved, as I said. She became very well known in that area, and it was her home. And it wasn't easy in the beginning. It wasn't easy, but
yeah, you talked about her having to overcome. I can imagine people's perceptions of her thick accent, but then also like the. Not that she seems like a terribly insecure person, but like the personal insecurity that comes from being in a place where you don't speak the language incredibly well.
And you don't know anyone except your husband, you know, even the relatives. I mean, it wasn't easy, but it was worth it. Let's put it that way. And I want to share something because you mentioned earlier, Ezra, that Mary would quote Martin Niemöller.
Uh-huh.
And I heard her do it so many times, and I want to read this to you. This is Niemöller. He died in 1984, and he was described by the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum as an ardent nationalist and prominent Protestant pastor who emerged as an outspoken public foe of Adolf Hitler and spent the last 7 years of Nazi rule in concentration camps. This is the poem. In Germany, they came first for the communists, and I did not speak out because I was not a communist. Then they came for the Jews, and I did not speak out because I was not a Jew. Then they came for the trade unionists, and I did not speak out because I was not a trade unionist. Then they came for the Catholics, and I did not speak out because I was a Protestant. Then they came for me, and there was no one left to speak for me.
Mm.
That says a lot right there. And one other thing I want to mention is I think Mary's story, along with all these wonderful memoirs we have of Holocaust survivors, I think that they can be used against bullying to show what happens. I mean, when you have to stand up. When I taught at La Crescent High School, I could watch. I mean, I saw this happen various times where a student was being bullied and students were standing around watching, and they thought as long as they didn't get involved that they were just fine. That's wrong. You know, I know peer pressure is very strong, and you don't have to. I don't expect you to tackle this right away in front of this person, but you can privately say, can you imagine what it must feel like walking in those shoes?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that Mary's story can be used as a tool against bullying, which is prevalent right now.
So Mary's story was originally collected in the recordings of her presentations. It was documented by Susan Hessel, who a lot of people, I mean, I grew up knowing Susan in a whole other context. I was friends with her children when I was growing up.
Mm-hmm.
But a local historian and writer. And then Steven Feinberg has been the reviser and editor of this edition.
Yes.
In the last couple of minutes that we have together, talk about the importance of his involvement in reissuing this story.
Well, I can tell you it's very important. I've known Steve for many years. We're very good friends. He used to be the outreach education director at the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C., so I called Steve and asked him if one of the jobs I was given when we were going to republish it, was I had done the original preface and my eulogy was at the back of the book. And they wanted me to find a big name in Holocaust education to do a preface. And then they wanted me to combine my preface with my eulogy and do an afterword. So, of course, I called Steve and I asked Steve if he would do a blurb. And he agreed. Of course, he would do that. And so we sent him the copy of the book. And he called me and he said, "Daryl, we got a problem with the book. Look at page 7. Go down to the 5th paragraph, the second sentence. Da da da. That's wrong." And he's going on and on and on. And I'm like panicking. I said, "Steve, what would it do? What would it take to get you to edit this book?" And he said, "I will do it as a favor for you."
Oh, wow.
I know. I mean, I'm telling you.
That's amazing.
Yes, it is amazing because he's so good. And he did it. And so from there, once we had the perfect copy, I asked Steve if he would. This name is going to mean nothing to local people, but there's a historian called Michael Birnbaum. He's with the Shoah Foundation, with Steven Spielberg's Shoah Foundation. He's looked at as one of the top Holocaust scholars in the whole world. And I asked Steve if he would ask Michael to do a blurb.
Mm-hmm.
He did a beautiful blurb. I was able to get Alexandra Zapruder, who spoke last year, actually. She edited a book called Salvage Pages, and it's diaries of young people that lived during the Holocaust. And she wrote the most beautiful preface. It just fell together. The people that I wanted to do blurbs, they did them as favors. And it's beautiful, and it's important, and I want everybody to read it. I go down to Pearl Street Books and see Beth. She's got them there for sale. You can even get them on Amazon. But get the book. Do yourself a favor. Get the book.
As you said, it's appropriate for adults. I mean, I read it in an evening plus maybe, you know, 30 minutes the next day or something.
Yeah.
And it's not a very long book, and the subject matter is perfectly appropriate.
Yes.
For maybe an early teen.
Middle school kids.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I tell you, I think it would be the best $15.95 you could spend.
It's called Squirrel is Alive, A Teenager in the Belgian Resistance and French Underground. And we've been talking to not the book's author, but certainly the book's earliest champion and the new edition's biggest champion as well, Daryl Klotte, who is a Holocaust educator and a friend of Mary Rosted, who's the subject of the book. Daryl, thank you very much for visiting with us today on Newsmakers.
I thoroughly enjoyed it, and thank you for inviting me.
Certainly, certainly. As Daryl said, there are a number of places where you can get a copy of the book if you're so interested, and you can listen to this conversation again if you would like. Our web address is WPR.org/newsmakers. That's WPR.org/newsmakers. There are two opportunities to hear our show every week on air. We're on Friday morning at 10 on the Ideas Network 90.3. We're on Friday evening at 7 on NPR News and Music 88.9. My producer is Kate Spranger. I'm Ezra Wall. We'll see you next time right here on Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio.